You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
With its slew of galleries and world-class museums, New York City has become the place to see, buy, and make art. But the art business has changed over the years. 10 days ago, we convened a panel in WNYC's Jerome L. Green space to take the pulse of the art world today. And joining us were Sean Kelly, the owner of the Sean Kelly Gallery in Chelsea, Carter Foster, a curator at the Whitney Museum of Art, and artists Pat Steer and Fred Wilson. It was a great conversation, and we are broadcasting it for you today. I began by asking Sean Kelly how the flurry of arts activity in New York, biennials, triennials, and the Armory shows, compared to other cities.
Nothing compares with New York, I think, is the honest truth. I mean, it's not, there is no comparison. It's just there is more choice here, and the entire city's like a great free art exhibition constantly between the museums and the galleries. So, I mean, it's overwhelming. I mean, the problem is getting to see everything.
Well, you could have opened a gallery in London, couldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah,
but so why did you choose New York?
It wasn't as interesting to me. I don't think it was as challenging. I don't think it was as exciting. And I think when I chose to move from being a curator and working in the public sector to working as a very deliberate choice at that moment to work in the private sector, which very few people did, nobody crossed over at that point, I thought, well, if I'm going to do this and make this extraordinary blunder in my career, I should do it in the most exciting place I can do it, the most challenging place I can do it, New York.
And that time that was Soho, and then... Then you moved to Chelsea?
Yep.
Because everybody was moving to Chelsea?
You just get priced out of the market, you know, very simply. I mean, the galleries, traditionally the galleries go in first, and the artists go in first, then the galleries, and then the market changes, and then the larger stores come in, and you get priced out of the market, and you move to a new area, and you open it up, and you keep rolling.
Carter, before you became the curator of drawings at the Whitney, weren't you at the L.A. County Museum of Art, and then...
Yes, for
the
years.
Cleveland Museum of Art, the New York Public Library. I'm assuming that if you follow Sean, you're going to wind up opening your own gallery. But do each of those institutions have a different philosophy, a distinct way of what they should be acquiring and showing?
Yeah, they collect in very different ways. The Cleveland Museum is an encyclopedic museum. I worked in the drawing department, which collected both Old Master and Modern Contemporary, so those are very different markets. I worked, in a way, more in the Old Master then. And some museums, LACMA, focused more on contemporary, just not because they didn't have older stuff, but because that was just sort of the nature of what they did at the time, kind of followed what was happening in L.A., I think. And the Whitney's mainly focused on post-war and certainly contemporary, obviously.
Yeah, an old master at the Whitney is what, John Maron?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. We have a sergeant in the collection, a Johnson Mission, but it's after 1900, so...
John, Fred, aren't you on the board of trustees of both the Whitney Museum and the American Academy in Rome?
Yes.
Does that make you a member of the art establishment?
I guess so.
But actually, you played at being a curator in the late 80s. You became a curator of sorts when you created this series of mock museum installations. Mm-hmm. And you're still
I still do that. Yeah. I have a big show in Savannah now, which is, it's in a museum, but I'm dealing with the museum itself again. But, just to be serious about what you said before, you know, being a trustee in a major museum is not unfamiliar with me because I work with all these different institutions around the country in museums, and I interacted with boards a lot and all levels of people at all levels in these institutions. But the Whitney particularly, I'm very at home in.
Well, when you're curating one of those shows, what are you doing? Are you making comments on the way museums operate?
Well, I like to say I'm not curating. It's sort of a kind of a trompe l'oeil of curating. It looks like that's what I'm doing, but actually it's a meta curating, and and I'm not really trying to make fun of anybody. It's just that I have a different vantage point to look at these institutions, and different ideas bubble up that maybe are not being spoken about or thought about, and so that's what comes out. Sometimes it's a little more controversial than other times, but
Pat, when you were studying at Pratt Institute in Boston University in the late 50s, early 60s, what did the teachers tell you about your chances of showing and selling your art?
They said a girl could never do it, that it was impossible. Go find a nice guy and go home. That's what they said.
And you didn't listen to them.
Not at all. I don't listen to anybody.
Well, you've had solo shows all over the world. You have one coming up at two Pace Galleries, right? And you've been at Chime and Reed. How do you find, you and the galleries find each other?
The show coming up is Pace Prince, they call it Pace Prince. Mm-hmm. Dick Solomon found me because I was making prints in California, and he liked those prints. He was walking up my stairway to see another artist. I opened the door to take some garbage out. He said, would you like to make a print? And that's how I met Dick Solomon. And we've been working together for about 10 or 15 years now. John Chime, I left a gallery, and I was looking for a new representation. I invited John Chime to the studio, and he asked me to join the gallery.
Sean, is it always that easy for artists?
I don't think so.
It's never that easy, but John is a lover of painting. And so he was working at Robert Miller at the time, so I went start to work with him at Robert Miller. He loves painting, and I make paintings, so not so many people make paintings anymore.
So, in fact, we're going to... Fred doesn't even work with his hands anymore, right? You say that's not something you're interested in?
Yes, I make art with my hands tied behind my back. No, well, that's... I never say never, so it's... currently, that's true.
Well, when... I'll ask both of you this. When you are connecting with a gallery, how much of an element of trust has to be established, and do you have to share a common aesthetic?
I think an element of trust, some element of at least the bottom line of trust has to be established. But it's very different now than it was when I started. When I started, the competition was for ideas between artists. That was my idea. I thought of it. Now it's like a business competition, so that people say... Artists don't ask each other, did you sell anything? They say, did you sell everything? So that's one big difference. There are two bottom lines. One is that when they're paid, they pay you. That's the bottom line. The other bottom line is if they don't want to work with you anymore, they tell you before they stop working with you. So those are the bottom lines. And then you ask for more and more and more. You ask for more loyalty, more faithfulness, more trust, more devotion to your work, more PR for you. You keep asking.
Fred, you have a show at the Pace currently called Venice Suite, Sala Longhi and Related Works. Were the pieces made in Venice?
Yeah, the show specifically, all things that I had fabricated in Venice, and I go to Venice several times a year and work with various people in Murano and elsewhere around Venice.
And did that relationship begin when you represented the United States at the Venice Biennale?
Yes, and I had no idea that it would continue this long, this sort of love affair with Venice and their visual forms. But it certainly did start then.
Well, you also represented the United States at the Cairo Biennial in 1992, but you're not going back to Cairo, are you?
It's just interesting how these things work out. I've been to Cairo many times, and actually I lived there when I was quite young because my father was working there. So I still have lots of friends, and I still I made it work for the Whitney Biennial about Egypt. And a lot of work soon after that, but it's been a lull in that kind of work that I've been doing.
Carter, how much of an impact have events like the Venice Biennale and Documenta in Kassel, Germany had on internationalizing art? I know you right now you're specializing in American art.
Before, you know, they've had an impact for a long time, certainly, and they helped internationalize the art world, and they were the precedents for the way it is now, in a sense, where everybody's constantly traveling around to these art fairs, biennials.
It seems like every major city has at least one art fair.
It seems like that, yeah. And one biennial, or two.
Well,
important.
And I think we've seen a conflation in, I mean, and I don't think this is necessarily a good thing, but I think perhaps the general public can't tell the difference between a biennial and an art fair. And, you know, you get this cacophony of things going on in all of them. You know, I don't know. It's an issue. I don't know if it's a problem.
But it's really, it's changed the art world to a large degree, hasn't it?
The biennials or the...
Yeah. In the old days, it was, you know,
artist... Well, there used to be
trying to have a gallery
and a lot more.
And then one, there was the Venice Biennale and a couple of others, and that was it. Now, we alone are having, I don't know, how many art fairs altogether this year?
Well, I think the difference is that when the art fair started, the dealers were buying art from the artists, and they would take what they owned to an art fair and sell it to each other. And that was the function. So if an American dealer went to the Bologna Art Fair and a dealer from Frankfurt went to the Bologna Art Fair and they each had art that the other didn't work with and didn't have access to, they could buy it from each other, bring it home, and sell it and show it at home. And that's what's changed, because now the art fairs are like exhibitions where everything is on, most of the dealers bring work they have on consignment and exhibit it the way they would at their home gallery. So the whole function of the art fair is different than it was.
Fred, Sean, do you feel pressured to be in as many art fairs as possible because of these changes?
Not particularly. I mean, I think we do art fairs because we want to reach different audiences and we want to structure relationships differently around the world. And I think what we should really be acknowledging is that we're all in a very fortunate position where the art world, it is very different to the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. You know, and there are things that we all miss about those periods that have gone, but that's change and that's how things progress. But I think we should all be acknowledging that we're in a very fortunate position at this point in history and at this point in this economy of actually being under pressure because so many people are interested in what we do. And that's an incredible, you know, gift to us.
And it is rather astonishing that it's that big of an economy. I'm always amazed at how much it can support.
It's a multi-billion dollar worldwide economy. And we are incredibly fortunate that what we do is having that much attention paid to it, whether it's economically or from audiences. If you go to the Museum of Modern Art and see Cindy Sherman's show, or you go and see the Whitney Biennial, you have to queue to get in. That's because people want to learn, they want to see, and they want to know.
You're listening to my March 21st discussion on the state of the New York art scene with artists Pat Steer and Fred Wilson, along with Sean Kelly, owner of the Sean Kelly Gallery in Chelsea, and Carter Foster, a curator at the Whitney Museum of Art. We have to take a quick break, but we will have more of our discussion when we return. Stay with us. We are back with the second half of a panel discussion in WNYC's Jerome L. Green Space on the changes in the New York art world with gallery owner Sean Kelly, Whitney curator Carter Foster, and artist Pat Steer and Fred Wilson. I asked the panel, starting with Carter Foster, how the Internet was changing the art world and whether artists are turning away from galleries and selling their work online.
It's something that didn't exist 10 years ago that exists now. I mean, there was this Internet Art Fair, which is at least it's actually useful for getting information and seeing. It's like any art fair, you can see a high concentration of work in one place, which is useful. But what I find interesting is people are willing to or able to buy without seeing an object, which would have been unheard of, I think, for a lot of people. And that's changed. That really has changed.
But the level it works at is a very low level. I mean, you know, if you want to sell something for $100 on the internet, people will do that. But it's antithetical to the very nature of what we do, which is to deal with exclusivity. And people want to stand in front of the object.
When they're spending
that kind of money, smart ones want to stand in front of the object and understand it.
Well, I think there are several different kinds of collectors, though. I mean, there are collectors who buy something without actually knowing what it is. And I just got an email from someone who said, I have a painting of yours hanging over my bed. I didn't recognize his name, and I always remember the names of people who own paintings. Because I didn't archive it on the computer until very late, and so I remember before then. I didn't recognize his name. He sent me a picture, and it was a very tiny silkscreen print. It was something completely different, and I don't know where he got it, because it was silkscreen, so there's 100 of them. They're a lot printed. And he just bought it somewhere off the internet or something. But that's one kind of collector who will spend a couple of thousand dollars for something small, or just is. And there are a lot of small things to buy. A lot of young artists selling work at low prices, or a lot of older artists like me making small multiples that sell for a low price. And so the audience has changed vastly. There are vast numbers of people who are artists. When I moved to New York, I went to a little dinner, and Robert Ryman said, "When you move downtown, I'll introduce you to everybody." And everybody was him, Lucy Lepard, Nancy Holt, Smithson, Solowit, Eva Hesse, and the Mangolds. That was everybody.
Well, people don't come into your gallery, Sean, and say, "Oh, this is nice, I like it. How much does it cost? I'll buy it." Do they?
Sure. Absolutely.
I would think that most of the work is sold either. Right now, there are consultants out there. There are people who follow certain artists' careers. There are corporations that are building art collections. Isn't that where most of the sales are?
Well, but as Pat says, there are as many different types of collectors as there are different types of artists and different types of galleries. And, you know, we operate in a certain way, but we are very, very receptive to people who come in, because from decades of experience, we know that, you know, somebody who you're nice to today can turn into a very important collector tomorrow. And we're at pains to make sure that they're accommodated when they come into the gallery.
Well, you don't sell anything on the opening, because all the people at the opening are the artist's friends, aren't they?
No. No to the second part.
Now, Fred, your work is a large installation. What are you selling? Are you selling small pieces connected to it, the equivalents of studies?
I sell large installations.
You mean will go into this current show at Pace and buy the whole room?
It's not unheard of. And but I also sell small works that I make, and different size works, and I sell ideas as works, and so again, it's the whole gamut. And I think now collectors have grown in complexity, like and interests as artists have, and so there's a variety of types of collectors too that are interested in a variety of types of art.
Well, we're seeing more and more artists who do work that I would call ephemeral. I mean, what do you do with somebody like Andy Goldsworthy, who does a show where he puts plaster on the wall that falls off the wall? You're not going to sell the shards. You can't sell the room. That must have changed the art, the art market as well, hasn't it?
There's a whole other world. I do large installations that are optical illusions, and then there's the world that wants them as an installation in a public place, because you can see it publicly. I'm sure that is what happens to a lot of your work too. So it's a deeper, it's a much bigger world. It's a much more confusing world. But it's since the mid '80s, the limits got further apart. It's less limited.
And now we're also seeing big shows that are the equivalent of museum shows. The galleries are big enough in Chelsea to do that. So we see a Picasso show, a Monet show, or you see something like the Doug Wheeler show, where you can't buy that show and put it in your house. Are those there for prestige for the galleries?
No, they're there to express the artist's ideas.
Well, Picasso is no longer expressing his
case,
and Monet especially.
In the case
especially.
Of Doug Wheeler,
yeah.
You know, they're there to express the bigger picture of the artist's ideas. And you know, I think the more interesting galleries, what we should be doing, is actually working with living artists, if we work with living artists, to allow them to express the full breadth of their interests. And you know,
but what does a commercial gallery get out of showing a a Picasso show, for example.
You're building a brand. I mean, you're contributing to or building a brand. And what we should be doing, the good galleries should be building their artist brands. If you want to be vulgar about it and talking contemporary terms, you should be creating a context for the broader landscape for that artist's work. And you should be being as adventurous and dynamic as you can be to show it to the widest possible public. And you make the greatest show you can, and then you worry about how the hell you're going to support it by selling things from the back room afterwards. That's our job.
I think the Doug Wheeler show, if we want to think about it another way besides a brand, it just introduced this artist to a large audience, and the fact that it got so much attention was probably a surprise to the gallery as much as anybody and the artist.
Well, they put a lot of money into that, David Zwirner, so I guess he wasn't that surprised.
I don't know if they expected lines, 4-hour people willing to wait in line for 4 hours. I don't think they expected that at all.
Well, what gets you to check out an artist's work? Do you go to all the openings, or do you only?
I don't go to all. I go to as much as I can, but like anybody, there's so much that just covering as much as possible, given whatever other things are going on.
Well, since you're the curator of drawings at the Whitney, do you tend to focus on shows that include drawings?
Not necessarily, no, because I think you have to. It's such a cross-media world now that I think I tend to focus on what I have time to do and what I'm near to, and also when I rely on colleagues and other artists to recommend shows.
Also, the whole definition of what is a drawing has changed, hasn't it?
Yes, it has, but I think it's interesting. We were just on a panel that dealt with the nature of drawing. And I think, in a way, drawing is still very traditional. In some ways, I think what's happened is that the market idea around it has shifted, and people are willing to buy works that represent process or represent what a drawing is in a more way that they would buy painting or something, and collect it in a way that painting and sculpture was more traditionally done before.
Well, the drawing could be wire now, or it could be also...
There's the metaphorical idea of drawing and the actual object of drawing. Yeah.
Now, why have the New York galleries moved so many times? So in my lifetime, the main gallery district was 57th Street and then up Madison Avenue. Then it shifted to Soho, and now all the big ones are in Chelsea. I'm assuming that it's because the galleries were looking for larger and larger spaces. But you couldn't have predicted that the High Line was going to have such an impact on that area when you moved to Chelsea.
No, I don't think those moves were made because of the High Line. Those moves were made because of space, and you get an extraordinary quality of space in that area, and you could get it for less money. Frankly, I mean, if you were looking in...
Not anymore, I suspect.
A ground floor... Well, I mean, we just announced today that we're moving to a new 22,000 square foot space in Hell's Kitchen. When we started looking a year ago, when we moved into Chelsea, it was $20 a square foot. Now ground floor is $150 a square foot, and that's in 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's just a straightforward economy and a quality of space issue. And Hell's Kitchen, you can move into that area and you can find great space for a quarter of what you'll pay in Chelsea now. And so, the artists move in, then the galleries move in, and then all the other infrastructure comes afterwards.
Yeah, but what about some of the other places? Williamsburg, has it lost some of its alternative status to Bushwick and the Lower East Side?
Williamsburg's more hip than Chelsea is. With the younger artists and the younger dealers, it's a much hotter scene in many respects. I mean, I think probably, that generation and with the younger artists and the younger crowd, we'd be regarded as being too establishment for them now. So,
I think the Lower East Side is definitely it's a different scene altogether. It feels less commercial. It feels much more artist-driven at this point in a way. I mean, not to put down Chelsea, but it's just a different vibe completely. Because it's a much, much lower... price. People are selling things for under $500 to $3,000, which is very different.
But as far as the Whitney is concerned, you're moving closer to Chelsea than you are to the Lower East Side.
Right, yeah, that's true. But the new museum moved to the Lower East Side.
There are a number of private museums have opened in recent years. How do they affect the market?
I think it's more just the collectors that run that are opening them affect the market because they have such large amounts of money. I think it's an interesting cultural shift. I mean, there's always been private museums, the Frick collection. There's museums in Paris that are people's private collection, but
in Berlin, you can practically do a museum.
But it seems like everybody wants to have their own space, or a lot of whether it's public or semi-public or whatever, just to showcase their art.
I think it's a major misnomer to call them private museums, frankly, because museum has a function and it has a fiduciary responsibility to the collection and the artists that it collects. And those private institutions just do not. And in many cases, they are very much to do with collectors wanting to have very large spaces to house their collections in, which they will open to the public. And that's a great thing, but they're not museums.
Mm. And they get a tax write-off because they've opened it to the public.
There are all sorts of implications.
Now, Fred, do you cultivate collectors? Did they come to you?
No, I don't cultivate collectors. I make lots of friends, but I don't, you know.
Because there are artists who have people who follow them.
I've been followed. No, I mean, well, that may be true, but some people, I sort of developed a lot of friends around the country and other countries. But I know there are artists who perhaps think a lot about gathering people who might be interested in buying their work, and I'm just not one of those people. I'm more interested in people than I am in that other side.
Pada, do you have some people who collect your work or corporations?
I have people who, well, both, but. There are people who collect my work who I've made friends with, who became... sometimes it becomes an intimate relationship because they live with you. And so they know more about the artist than the artist knows about them because they live with the artist. And sometimes they're very affectionate to me and I feel affectionate back. And we become friends, and so yes, but cultivate collectors. Like go out and find people who, you have to have a different kind of social talent than I have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't. I have to wait to be found.
What about reviews of gallery shows? Does a good review in the New York Times guarantee sales?
Of course, it makes a difference. I mean, the media makes a difference. I wouldn't say it guarantees sales, but obviously, you know, it makes a difference. I think the thing is that that's a very, very short-term gain. And
usually often the reviews come out on Friday and the show is closing on Saturday.
Yeah, and I mean, I think good galleries are, you know, like long-distance runners. I mean, they're supporting artists over the long haul. And they really, we don't pay attention to those things in terms of whether it's going to make a difference to the sale or not. I mean, I think if we get a bad review, I'm always disappointed for the artist because you want to do your best for the artist. And you know that being an artist and putting your work into a public space is an incredibly vulnerable thing to do. And if somebody has a go at them, and reviewers occasionally do, quite gratuitously, it's very disappointing, frankly. And you feel for the artist.
What about museum shows, being in the Whitney Biennial? Does that help a career?
I think, all these different things sort of help your career in different ways, and sometimes doesn't make itself, you're not aware of it till a while after, you know. I don't know about what you think of that and what you think.
When I was young, I was in what was then the Whitney Annual quite often, and... it gave me a start. Yes, it gave me a start. I was in one biennial when I was older, and it didn't seem to make much of a difference because people already knew the work, so they just said if they liked it or not.
And so how are prices set, Sean? I know an artist who's concerned that his gallery has priced him too high, and that's actually going to hurt his career.
Oh, it's absolutely possible. I mean, price is a rather subjective science. And I think that, you know, you take a lot of experience and you look at where the artist is at. You have a sense of where you believe they should be. And you have a sense of, how far you feel you can push the envelope. But, you know, it's a very important and fine balance. And actually, over the years, I've learned to listen to the artists because... you know, this is supposed to be our department, but I think artists are very, very savvy about this. And you need to, as a dealer, you need to listen to them. Because
and if you start selling a young artist for, let's say, $30,000, a painting, we'll say, and they don't sell, you still can't go back and start selling them at 20,000.
It's very hard to get back into the water if you're stranded on the beach. It's not a comfortable feeling. But I do think that it is an important part of what we do. As I say, I mean, I've learned to listen to the artists because I think artists are very savvy about their careers. They understand where they want to be at any given point and what their comfort levels are. And, you know, a good dealer-artist relationship is like a good marriage. And you need to find a chord within that relationship. And if you're pushing too hard, you're just not going to do that.
There have been some instant stars who just seem to be coming out of grad school. Do you go to MFA programs and look for young artists?
No.
So where do you find your... Well, somebody must.
I don't because I think it's incredibly dangerous. I think that artists... I hope that we still have enough perspective to understand that artists need time to mature. They need time to become seasoned. They need time to develop their work and find their voice. Otherwise, you're going to destroy them. And I don't go and do it quite specifically because I think it's a very dangerous thing to do.
So how do you find artists? Obviously, you're not welcoming people showing up with some slides or whatever.
We get people doing that all the time. And we look at them all, too. Most galleries do not. We do that. I know it's probably a dangerous thing to say on the radio, but we do that.
How many of you people are going to be showing up tomorrow, John Kelly?
And
there's one.
And, you know, we have had artists walked into us and introduced to us that we now represent. The way we find them is we listen to curators, we listen to artists primarily, we listen to their peers, and we travel all over the world all the time, and we look, and we love what we do, and we're in studios all the time, we're looking at shows all the time, and, you know, we're keeping it fresh and looking for great artists.
We don't have much time left, in fact, just about 5 minutes or so, but I wanted to invite the audience to join in this conversation, and we're bringing out some mics. There's somebody here, yeah?
If you could each say how you measure your success.
Okay, well, let's begin with you, Carter.
I would say the nature of the projects I do and whether or not myself and my colleagues are satisfied with it.
Yeah. I think it's by the quality of the exhibitions and making the best exhibition we can make for our artists in the world. And if we do that, then we're successful and we worry about everything else after that.
Well, I think that if I can make my work every day and that I can exhibit it, I think that's pretty good.
And I suspect you also, Fred, like the idea of stirring things up a bit. That would be part of the success, getting people to think about...
Well, yes, getting people to think, I suppose. Basically getting myself to think. I think people think that I kind of stir things up to get people stirred up, but it's not at all true. I'm sort of stirring my own juices to sort of push something out, and then I'm sometimes surprised that people have other ways of viewing what I do. But I have to say that if there wasn't any kind of thought process and people kind of really trying to grapple with what I'm bringing up, then I would not consider that a success. But it's not something I'm trying to get people riled up or anything.
Well, we've run out of our allotted time, and there are also I'm sure all sorts of other questions we could ask, but I think we've done a pretty good job. I thank the four of you so much for being so open. You've been a great panel.
Thank you.
Carter Foster, Sean Kelly, Pat Steer, Fred Wilson.